Welcome to the Inspirati, presented by Nuvo. I'm Alex Merrill, and for season two, I am thrilled to be teaming up with Canada's authority on the exceptional, Nuvo Magazine, to showcase a collection of international creative luminaries who are sculpting, welding, crafting, and forging a path forward with originality and finesse. We share these intimate conversations to shine a light on risks taken, guts trusted, hunches explored. We share them with the hope that they will ignite something in you. The Inspirati was created for those seeking inspiration and those seeking to inspire. Please enjoy. While Tom Dixon is a household name in British design and even a living, breathing symbol of the country's aesthetic today, there is no denying that he has forever been a true original. Born in Tunisia and raised in Morocco and Egypt before moving to England, Tom's exotic early influences and the inheritance of elegant sensibilities from his French mother ignited a quest for a new way of seeing and, in due course, of making. This drive has taken him around the world in search of inspiration, but long before he was channeling his creativity into luxurious light fixtures and free-spirited furniture, he was traveling on slightly different terms. Tom played bass in a band that at one point flew to New York to open for The Clash, which gave him a first taste of entrepreneurship, what it's like to create a product, promote that product, and build a following and a life on your own terms. His career as a musician was cut short by one of a couple of motorcycle crashes that changed his trajectory. This landed him in the London nightclub scene, where he began to weld salvaged steel into design pieces for the club's patrons. The eclectic mix of clients required originality, and Tom's early projects, a set for a photo shoot, a hairdresser's salon, a fashion designer's window display, allowed for a kind of play often reserved for the unschooled. Eventually, he was approached by Capellini to bring his design sensibilities to the legendary Italian furniture company, which was followed by his tenure as creative director of the UK household furnishing brand Habitat. Dixon was awarded the Order of the British Empire in 2001 by Her Majesty the Queen for his contribution to British design. A year later, he established his eponymous design brand, which specializes in furniture, lighting, and accessories. Tom Dixon is now represented in 90 countries, has hubs in London, Milan, Hong Kong, New York, Tokyo, and Shanghai, and employs over 100 people globally. Tom filled me in on the highs and lows of the convergence of COVID and Brexit, which led not only to supply chain disruptions, but to an intense period of creation in a greenhouse owned by the oldest orchid business in the world, reigniting in him the kind of play intrinsic to his early career. We discussed the beauty to be found in the first of something, being motivated by surprises, and why you should go to as many parties as possible. Please enjoy this conversation with the unparalleled Tom Dixon. I have to start by saying I got a bigger apartment in Vancouver this year after being in a shoebox in New York for a decade. And a friend of mine who's very cool sent me photos of his big collection of your melt pendants and said, you have to get these for your place. And that week I found one unexpectedly. And it was one of the first things I bought for my home.
You're in Vancouver.
I am.
So do you know the people at Inform?
Yeah, exactly. So I went to Inform and saw Nancy and Lauren, and they had one of your wall pieces. And so that ended up being in my house.
Yeah, I love those people.
Yeah, they're wonderful. They're wonderful. And I feel like when you're in a rental, if you change the lights, the place is like suddenly yours.
Okay.
You know what?
I think I'm going to interview you, actually.
I don't know. I'd rather be sitting on the floor under like a great light fixture with no chairs for some reason, which isn't very practical. But how's everything been in London?
Well, you know, it's I don't know if you have the game of snakes and ladders over there, but it's been a bit like that. So, you know, every time you think that you're winning, you slide back to, you know, to a worse position than before, then you climb up. But, you know, I kind of almost like chaos in a way. Not that I needed quite as much chaos as has happened over the last 2 or 3 years. And of course, you know, for us, there's COVID plus Brexit, which makes it kind of a double whammy, as we say here. And you know, hugely complex to navigate if you're basically an import-export business with a restaurant on top, you know. So it's caused all kinds of complications. And there's no sign of things really improving particularly.
Has it been a nightmare on the supply chain front?
That's really starting to appear now. So this is quite recent. You know, obviously it's been difficult because, you know, we make things all over the world. You know, Germany is our biggest country of origin, but all electrical components come from China, and we do handicraft in India. So each of these kind of blocks have been hit at different times with different problems. And then even if you're manufacturing in the UK, you know, the problem is you can't get the raw materials. So it's been really disruptive. But I think the true costs of it are just coming through now, you know, with everything going up, you know, with this container freight, which you have, you know, yourself over there in North America, but also the cost of cardboard and every single thing is going up. So it's going to be challenging again. But, you know, I guess design is a problem-solving kind of profession. So right. These challenges are sent to test us, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Has there been an upside creatively, just having a bit more space and time?
Yes. I mean, I think that lockdown was kind of probably relatively good for me, almost like a sabbatical. And, you know, that's not to downplay the damage it's had on so many people. But, you know, when you're used to being the boss of 100 people and you're doing everything in a kind of commercial way. I managed to find myself a greenhouse in the countryside.
Wow.
Basically because I was being bullied at home by my family. and so I needed to find somewhere to escape. But I found myself a huge commercial greenhouse of a friend of mine that owns probably the oldest orchid business in the world.
Wow.
And I was able to play like I did right at the beginning. So I kind of remembered why I was doing design in the first place, just for the pure joy of creating, really. And so most of that stuff, you know, I made it and then I put it in the skip. And then started all over again. It wasn't precious. It wasn't, you know, it had no business motivation, and most of it was utter rubbish. But it was playful and it was more radical and it was refreshing for me, yeah.
And what was that creative process like? Were you alone? Were you with a team? Were you blasting music?
I was alone in huge amounts of space and light, you know. So I think, you know, when I started out in London a long time ago, London was cheap and affordable, so you could get big spaces, right? But most of them tended to be kind of hulking, great dark warehouses, but space is a supreme luxury. And then, you know, the luminosity of the place and the fact that there was no music and there was no infrastructure, no tools, actually, just a lot of rough and ready materials. You know, the bamboo sticks from the greenhouse, the broken glass, the, you know, just bits of metal from next door, mud. You know, so quite primitive, quite feral, actually.
Yeah, yeah, and a bit of a return to childhood play as well.
Yeah.
So you were born in Tunisia. Do you have any memories of life there?
I was born in Tunisia, but I also lived in Morocco and Egypt. So I have memories of all of those places, but I left when I was 4. So most of the memories are actually animals. I mean, I remember camels. You know, turning a water wheel. I remember flying fish from the boat journey across the Mediterranean. I remember a locust storm with the locusts, you know, crushing against the windscreen wiper in our Citroen, you know, car. And so I remember sardine couscous. So it was all kind of, yeah, animals and not really a great deal else.
Right. And what did your parents do?
Well, my father was in his first teaching job, teaching English to foreign students. And my mother was a student, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
Not a young student, you know, more university student, right? And I mean, more recently, then my mother was working for the World Service of the BBC, so translating the news from English into French and reading it as a newscaster. My father remained an English teacher.
And then you all moved to London when you were, was it 6?
I moved to Huddersfield when I was 5, which is the north of England, quite, you know, quite cold and wet. And then London when I was 6, yeah.
And what was your school experience like? What kind of student were you?
Very introverted, I'd say, and quite bookish. I mean, I used to like reading a lot, you know. So, I mean, the schools, particularly the secondary school that I attended, were kind of failing state schools. They weren't, I mean, they're really not academic, and they were very short on discipline, you know. So there was a lot of kind of, I don't know, there was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of of trouble and not a lot of learning. But I was it was a really big school, 2,000 pupils, and it had amazing facilities for metalwork, for ceramics, particularly photography. So it was good on the arts and on the crafts as well. So I think I took refuge in the ceramics department.
Nice. And was that when you were starting to ride motorcycles as well?
No, I mean, you're not allowed to ride a motorcycle until you're 17 in the UK. So, yeah, I mean, that was just at the end of school. Yeah. So, yeah. So, I mean, I started, I mean, I was on bicycles. I mean, I was always had wheels, you know.
Right. Best way to get around. And then when you got out of school, did you have sort of a string of odd jobs, or what was the next step?
So I kind of I went straight to art school, but I lasted about 3 months before I had a motorcycle accident, which where I broke my leg, and I never went back. I mean, I just, you know, I'd had enough of school, to be frank, and I'd only gone to art school because I couldn't think of what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I really didn't have an art school career. I went straight and worked as a technician in another art school, actually. So I joined the work, you know, the workshop, the machine shop, you call it probably over there, and then learned how to use machine tools for my first year out of college. I was on the other side of the coin, you know, there at 7 o'clock sweeping the floor, making the tea for the old engineers that were running a place, and learning how to use the machines, and then looking after the students when they had projects. Then I colored in cartoons for animated films when they were still colored in by hand, which, you know, is the way that the cartoon films were made until about 15 years ago. I was a graphic designer for about 3 months on doing horror films in video in a video company. And then the band that I was in took off. So I was playing music like everybody was at the time in London. I can't think of anybody who wasn't in a band, but ours kind of took off. And it took me around the world, and that specifically to New York, where we supported The Clash on Broadway, actually.
So wow.
That was, you know, in principle fantastic, but I don't actually remember very much of The Clash. I do remember that their crowd was very hostile because we were playing disco music and it was a punk crowd. So there was a lot of beer bottles flying at that time. So it certainly toughened us up. And actually got me slightly less introverted, less shy, and, you know, and more robust, if you like. Being in a band is quite a kind of, you know, it's a hell of a school for actually sinking or swimming.
How did you gravitate towards the bass? Bass players are such a specific kind of cool.
No, it wasn't like that. Everybody else grabbed the cool instruments, and then you know, you're left with but, you know, the advantage of the bass is it's relatively easy to learn. I mean, it's not that easy to be really good at it, but you know, as a kind of basic instrument, it seems to have it seems to be the one that nobody really wants to do when you're 14 or whatever when I started. But it was fine. It suited me. You know. Can you tell me a bit more about the specific type of cool that's associated with bass players, please?
It's this kind of like nonchalance. They're not gripping the microphone, desperate for your attention. There's this nice kind of like laid back,
okay,
I'm fine with or without you kind of vibe that's like really specific to bass players.
Really? Okay, good. I'm glad that's finally been explained to me.
My pleasure. What do you think you learned from that time in terms of attitude and aesthetics that you've maybe carried through your artistic career, other than that bass player vibe, which may or may not apply?
I mean, you know, I've been asked a lot, has music influenced you in your designs? And actually, not in the designs, but definitely in the method, you know, because I think what's interesting, if I look back on music, is really the way that you create your own future, in a way. You're making up your own assets, and you're selling them. Okay, so it doesn't seem like selling at the time. You might be writing a song. I mean, certainly you learn your own instrument. I mean, you know, we had no formal training like most people in contemporary music don't have a formal training. So it also taught you that you could make it up as you went along, right? So, and I think that that do-it-yourself attitude is kind of, you know, then becomes something where you're having to promote your own work, you know, so you do your own posters, you book your own gigs, and you tell your friends about it, you know, and that kind of self-propelled business, because it's that little business unit in the end. And then finally you sign a deal with a big company, and it's kind of got a parallel with where I am now, because, you know, I'm owned by private equity. And so suddenly you're owned by a corporate, which is a very different dynamic, actually, and has a series of very different consequences as well. But the same rules kind of apply to me now. I think of an idea, and then I try and get it out to the people. So those lessons were very valuable lessons, I think, and really taught me that I didn't have to work for other people, particularly that my ideas had some value, and that people would and also how important it is to be different rather than the same, I think is another important lesson.
For sure. And what ended that chapter in music?
Well, the second motorbike accident. I probably had about 7 or 8 in my time, but these two were kind of formative. So the first one stopped me from art school, but the second one, where I broke my wrist, we were about to go on tour the following week, and I'd been I mean, it's a terrible thing, but I was looking at a girl in the street whilst I was riding, and I smashed into a car. So I landed in front, very embarrassed, in front of the girl, and pretended everything was fine, but it wasn't fine because I'd broken my wrist. And I was replaced by a much better bass player, who's a session bass player, who still has played since with Brian Ferry, and is now the substitute for Roger Waters in the Pink Floyd. So I always believed that that could have been my destiny, but he was a better bassist than me.
So that happened. And then were you working at a night in a nightclub at this point?
So by that time we'd started doing, you know, taking over clubs first for just the Monday night, really inspired by our visits to New York, which at the time was the sort of the fading part of Studio 54. Area and all those clubs that were kind of seminal clubs, and we thought we'd bring back a bit of that and the music to London. So we did that, and that provided a great living, because it was nocturnal activity, mainly on Friday and Saturday nights, eventually, which left the whole day free to experiment in other things. And that's when I took up welding.
I went to a show at the Barbican in London on nightlife a few years ago, and it explored all these clubs and cabarets throughout history and how they contributed to culture, from like the Moulin Rouge, obviously, through underground cafes in Berlin and Mexico and Tehran. And these places not only, you know, gathered artists and became sort of hotbeds for collaboration and avant-garde movements, but were in themselves incredible creative spaces with stage design and puppet theater and poster art. There was this one really cool club in Rome that had 3 floors representing heaven, purgatory, and hell. And there was this amazing tapestry of like dancing demons in the show from the hell floor. I think phones have obviously wrecked a lot of what was wonderful about nightclubs. But what was the scene like in London then? Did it feel like it had that kind of bubbling creativity to it?
Yeah. And I think, you know, there was, you know, obviously a very strong music scene in the mid 80s with a lot of activity. And then there was the New Romantics, and there was, you know, some amazing fashion and some real creativity in making clothes. And it was quite tribal, you know, the with the goths and the New Romantics and the skinheads and the mods, and, you know, and that doesn't really happen. Everybody seems to be relatively similar, listening to all kinds of music, you know, definitely much less distinct style. So it was a hotbed of innovation and passion for a specific music style or a specific fashion style. You know, there's people like Lee Bowery as well, that was kind of extraordinary, and the mix of kind of people from dance and from photography and from fashion. So, you know, a great kind of melting pot. And, you know, the people that I met there eventually became, you know, the people that were my first
clients, you know, hairdressers that wanted a salon welded up, or a you know, photographer that wanted a stage set, and so on, you know, film, video, you know, fashion people always want the latest thing for their window displays or their photo shoots. So it was kind of great because, you know, if you run a club, you know a lot of people superficially, albeit, but they kind of know how to get hold of you. And that network, I always say to students, you know, go to as many parties as you can, because that will become eventually the people that you depend on later.
And I'm sure being a young motorcycle driving bass wielding punk, you weren't interested in doing something in design that was played out, or like you said, was something that, you know, you'd already seen. How do you think you wanted your voice to stand out in those early days?
Well, I didn't, you know, it wasn't like it was a conscious decision to stand out. But I mean, it was, I guess it was easier to be anti-establishment then than it is now, because, you know, it seems like every youth movement or radical idea is very quickly commercialized and becomes mainstream so much faster. So it was kind of,
it's a Pepsi commercial a week later.
Yeah. So there, at least there was time to be slightly anti-establishment and be opposite to the dominating style. Whereas I think right now it's kind of legitimate to be, you know, to be any style. I mean, and it's authorized. You don't need to be counterculture. I mean, you know, from a design standpoint, it really was the time of, I guess, postmodernism for the first time round. And I found that quite distasteful. I wanted things that were rougher and less colorful. And yeah, so, I mean, yeah, I've forgotten your question.
No, that was perfect. So at the time you were welding salvaged steel. Was that the primary material you started working with?
Well, it was just what I was practicing on when I learned how to weld. So we'd gone to the scrapyard just to get some scraps to practice the welding. And you know, I was kind of taken by the speed at which I could make things. I'm very impatient, and I mean, I have the attention span of a flea. So there was something nice about the power to join things very quickly and make things that could then later be taken apart and remade. You know, we think that if you're a potter or a woodworker, you have to be much more patient, you know, and if once you've made something, it's very hard to break it up and remake it. Whereas metalwork, particularly with welding, you're able to, it's like a glue gun. I mean, things go together really quickly, but they go together in a really strong way. So I loved the fire and the rust. And then the pieces that we found at the scrapyard started kind of defining the aesthetics of the objects that we were making. So that was kind of great as well, a kind of byproduct. You're sort of like leapfrogging a stage of shape making by using ready-made components that already had a previous life and a patina or a shape to them. So it was assemblage, it was collage. And so that again kind of sped me up in terms of being able to make lots of things really quickly that had a very specific aesthetic and attitude, which, you know, is kind of embarrassing to look back at some of those things now because they're so badly made and they're so ugly. they had a distinct attitude, you know, which I think is also something which, when I speak to people now, is that it's quite hard to define a unique aesthetic. And again, if you do, it's sort of pounced on. Whereas, you know, it was quite good to be anonymous for a while and not be on Instagram or immediately kind of mediatized. So you had time to kind of build a kind of personality, which I think is harder to do now, because everything's so exposed.
Well, you become really reactive with your audience if you're on social media and everything else, I think.
Yeah, probably. And influenced by what works and what doesn't work, kind of thing.
Right, in more of a real-time kind of way.
Mm.
Outside of the club, who was your work resonating with at that time?
Well, you know, London was in the middle of a pretty severe recession. And, you know, it wasn't a very design-aware country. You know, it's quite nostalgic, still quite a lot of kind of chintzy Victoriana, and or what was considered modern was really a rehash of Bauhaus, so, you know, a style which was already 80 years old, you know, which resonated with the bankers, particularly the chrome and black leather kind of look, which was having a renaissance around about then. But London was a crossroads of a lot of people in finance or art. And, you know, so very quickly we picked up by Japanese were very interested in London at the time. and the Germans loved what was going on here. So an international crowd that was slightly more, I'd say, savvy from an art perspective, picked up on the kind of, I mean, it wasn't really design that I was doing. I was doing kind of assemblages, really, and it had a kind of artistic method, if you like.
And then how did you begin working with Capellini? Was that, what was that in terms of timeline?
Well, maybe, you know, I'd been making studio pieces, if you like, and also doing metalwork for all kinds of people that just needed extravagant objects. And maybe for 6 or 7 years before Capellini came to London to seek, you know, some novelties. I guess the Italian design scene had become quite self-referential, and a lot of things were, everybody went through the same master's studios, you know, dominated by, you know, 6 or 7 kind of amazing personalities. But I think Capellini felt the need for some freshness, and so he'd already picked up on a couple of people that were working in London, and he just came to my studio and selected a few pieces that he made, you know, for a show in Milan. Yeah.
What was it like jumping into working with Italians after spending your career in London?
Well, it felt a bit like home. I mean, you know, I traveled a lot to Italy as a kid, and so I mean, you know, I loved that the people could speak a tiny bit of Italian. But what was amazing was sort of the industry, you know, the kind of passion for quality in the factories, which, you know, I hadn't encountered before, partly because I was making my own things, but mainly because British industry was either huge, you know, kind of car companies, or very specialist and not interested in doing anything different. So what was great about the Italians is they had a kind of, you know, a much more flexible, much more family-run kind of system, and design really mattered to them. You know, they'd seen the power of design in transforming Italian industry post-war, and they knew it mattered. You know, so you got this sudden kind of interest and respect for what you did, which was completely novel to me. So, you know, it's the first time I sort of realized that I was a designer, and also the first time where people who weren't kind of from my scene were interested in. So, you know, if an engineer in a metalwork factory, you know, is kind of interested in discussing it, the mother and grandmother of Capellini would have a view, you know, and they'd all discuss the things because it was important to them. And I love that kind of family attitude, which just doesn't exist in the UK. And I don't think really a lot in the US either.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely. It's wonderful when you have that sort of family lineage dedication to artisanship and craft. Mm. And that's where you created the S chair, right? Is it true that the idea came from a doodle of a chicken?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you never really know what's true and what's funny. Once you've repeated a story 100 times, you know, that, right. I think it probably is actually. But I mean, typically the departure point was very different from what it ended up like. I mean, there are a couple of really horrible chicken-shaped chairs, which aren't quite S's yet, which are floating around in auction rooms, which I really wish would kind of collapse and vanish, because there's a lot of stuff that I really would like never to see again. But anyway,
have you ever bought anything just to get it off the market?
No, I don't want to have any contact with it.
So, did you go straight to Habitat from there?
No, so I'd done, you know, I'd kind of expanded the studio. I had maybe 17 or 18 kids working, making things in a big kind of disused factory in South London. I had a little retail shop. I'd tried doing a plastics company. I was very entrepreneurial, but I was very untutored. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing in finance, in marketing, in business, just generally, certainly not in factory management. And so it was all feeling a bit shaky. And I had a friend that was leaving Habitat at the time and said, oh, do you want my job? And I said, well, I'll go and have a look. I ended up not doing his job, but there was a more interesting job available, which was head of design at the, there was two design studios, one in Paris and one in London. And it was head of design at the London one. So I started there and I loved it. In the meantime, all of my friends thought I was being, you know, they were appalled because it was seen as joining, you know, joining the establishment. But I mean, for me, it was more radical than keeping on making rusty metal furniture, you know.
What was it like to be surrounded by design, but not really designing yourself.
The group was IKEA group. So I didn't become creative director of IKEA. I was just creative director of Habitat, but that was a bit closer to, say, I don't know, Crate and Barrel or something in the US. And,
right.
And so 70 stores, but part of this bigger group where we had quite a lot of interaction with the IKEA people. So what was amazing was just being exposed to so many different manufacturing techniques, so many different typologies of design that normally I'd never have a chance to be exposed to. So, you know, plush, cuddly toys, for instance, or art prints or plants, you know, so all of these things that are not normally considered to be design objects, you have to have a design attitude towards and a retail attitude towards as well. And then a lot of information. I mean, I think most designers don't get exposure to, you know, every week exactly what's sold in exactly what store in that town and how many, you know. Quite exciting to see the kind of stuff taking off, or, you know, very depressing to see the stuff failing. But you get that instant feedback loop that I think very few designers have had, you know, access to. And then, like I say, that the whole world of sourcing from China to Vietnam to France to Poland, you know, where really you start to know how everything was made and where everything was made in the world, which I don't think that many people either have had exposure to.
Yeah, I'm sure that was incredible for setting up your own company, just having that background in business as well. It's just design.
Yeah. I mean, I came away with a load of assumptions which were completely wrong from that experience, you know, so it really was like starting all over again. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, I learned a lot for sure.
So then you launched your eponymous line in 2002 at a time when personal brands were not really common in interior design. In choosing to design under your own name, what was that process like, just from the standpoint of giving yourself permission to be that visible?
Well, it was just pragmatic. I mean, I thought of lots of other names which I thought would be kind of more interesting. I didn't particularly want to stick my name above the door, but it was a pragmatic way of kind of turbocharging a business. And also, I was very conscious of the fact that fashion design is that is almost the standard model, where you put your name above the door, you do your own design and distribution, your own marketing, you have your own stores. And it didn't exist in design. It just felt like a much more obvious way to manage your own output than, say, having a studio and then expecting lots of other brands to distribute your ideas. So I mean, I was quite clear on what the concept was, and I was just surprised that not everybody was doing this. It just seemed obvious to me. I mean, the reality behind it is that the reason why people don't do it is much more difficult than you'd imagine, and there's much less infrastructure. Like fashion is more difficult because it's faster, but from a manufacturing perspective, it's repeatable. So everything is always sewn, everything goes into the shop on a rack, and you have many sizes, which also adds complexity, but you repeat that every season, right? Whereas in furniture, as soon as you think of another object, it's a different size, different box, different manufacturing technique. It becomes very complicated very quickly.
So now your headquarters are in London's King's Cross. Can you tell me about that building? I know it's got a really interesting history.
Well, it goes back to clubs. You know, maybe 20 years ago, the King's Cross was a very derelict area, like behind most railway stations, I'd say, with, you know, an amount of prostitution and a lot of drugs use and also, you know, underground clubs. So this building was a club. A lot of people remember it from, you know, 20 years ago as a techno club. But originally, it's part of the Victorian infrastructure of London, where coal, it's called the coal office because coal was brought down from the industrial north to London, which was a coal-powered city, and then distributed along the canal, which is behind the building, and all by horse-drawn cart to the rest of London. So it was really a very much the center of a network. And what's kind of interesting now is that it's part of a kind of new modern network, still with a lot of transport kind of links, you know, to Brussels and to mainland Europe through Eurostar, but also a lot of kind of knowledge networks. So Google have got their headquarters here, as have Facebook, and United Artists and various people.
Wow, what a collective. What are your other outposts at the moment?
Well, New York, I have a shop. And, you know, we have an office in Hong Kong. And we have shops in Beijing and Shanghai, one in Tokyo. But those are run by partners rather than ourselves. So, yeah, London, New York, Hong Kong.
And how many products at this point are in your range?
Ooh.
Roughly?
It depends how you count, doesn't it? I mean, if you count color variations and the rest of it, you know, right. It's called SKUs. We're probably talking about 1,000, but the reality is there's probably only about, I don't know, 300 products, you know, and then different sizes and different variants of those, 300 or 400 maybe.
And main categories would be lighting, furniture, and accessories?
No, you're getting very serious.
Okay. Getting very serious.
yeah, I mean, so accessories also includes, you know, fragrance, which is, I'd say, very different category.
Yeah.
Tableware and decorative objects. Yeah, furniture includes upholstery and normal furniture. We don't do case goods, for instance. And then lighting is the biggest because it seems to be the thing where you can be the most experimental and most modern, really.
Is the fragrance home fragrance or personal?
It's home, okay. Although I just splash it on myself. So I'm the only person that has it as personal fragrance. Yeah.
What was the process like for figuring out what you wanted a home to smell like?
Well, you know, I'd initially kind of thought I'd never do it. It didn't feel like that appropriate. But I think the more I design into spaces, the more I noticed some of those intangibles, which could be acoustics, definitely luminosity, but also the smell of a place becomes, I think, more and more important. I've had so many bad experiences with smells and with sounds, actually, in spaces that have been poorly designed, that I think smell is probably more important than we think. So, I mean, the departure point for me is that, you know, most perfumiers are probably a bit too expert for me. You know, they make the thing more complicated than I think it possibly needs to be. So for me, it's more process simplification and homing in on smells from a design perspective, try to get as much distinction between the different smells and probably slightly, it's not that they're not subtle, it's that they're just simpler probably than a perfumier's fragrance. And then trying to find things that have different actions, you know, of calming or heightening a space or cleansing a space, you know, and trying to find specific, you know, functional reasons to have those smells in your spaces.
Right. And in applying your eye and your hand and I guess your nose
and my nose, yeah.
And your nose to all of these to all these different categories, how would you describe the evolution of your exploration of materials and techniques over the past 20 years?
Well, it remains, you know, relatively similar to when I started, you know, in terms of the obsessions are still with, you know, the material and then the manufacturing technique, which might be industrial on one hand or quite craft on the other. But I still love, you know, materials being the hero of the piece and then trying to find ways of manipulating the material where your outcome is something which doesn't look too much like something that already exists, which is tricky, basically, you know, because so many things exist. And then, you know, I try and you know, my latest phrase is called expressive minimalism, where I really want the object to speak of its function and not to lose that in the process of reducing, you know, visual noise. I mean, I tend not to use pattern or applied decoration. There seems to be a lot of decoration that comes through from, you know, an overexpressed structure or an overexpressed function.
It's nice because I think the fact that there is this simplicity to your work really allows it to sort of interact with the environment in a really interesting way, where the environment kind of, especially with your lighting, there's so much mirror, kind of becomes a part of the piece.
You are too kind. Yes, thank you.
Do you feel connected to England specifically at this point in terms of cultural heritage and contributing to that lineage?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's endless. I was, you know, much inspired by, you know, my visits to museums and stuff in my youth. And there's no doubt that even in a world which mainly eats McDonald's and mainly, you know, wears baseball caps and tends to be kind of all traveling to the same places, there still are national characteristics of people, and they do count. It's easier for me to talk about, you know, other design races, if you like, you know, and do some cultural stereotyping of say the Japanese or the Germans or the Italians. It's much more difficult for me to look at myself and say, well, you know, this is what British design looks like. But the departure point of where I started was, you know, being in awe of the Victorian engineers and the slightly more kind of heavyweight and slightly less designed objects that came from that period. I mean, the easiest way to typify it is a distinction between a Land Rover and a Mercedes, maybe, or a Ferrari. I mean, you know, the things are slightly less, they're a bit more brutal, they're a bit less designed, and they're more kind of expressing that functionality, if you like, rather than style or over engineering, you know.
I do love an old Defender.
You do? Okay.
Stylistically.
I mean, I do drive the precursor of that, yeah, Series 1.
Well chosen. What other places do you feel connected to or inspired by now?
Well, I'm partly French. You know, I hold a French passport as well. So I've got a kind of other side to my personality. French was my first language. My mother's half French. So I've got an alternative place in my heart, you know, on the other side of the channel. But from the perspective of places that are inspiring, God, you know, where do you start? I mean, I was in Africa a couple of years ago before COVID hit in Senegal, and that, you know, really struck me as kind of so fresh, and, you know, a whole continent of opportunity there, which, you know, often has been thrown away or destroyed by invaders, if you like. I've got a lot of time still for India, where we make a lot of things, where, you know, India isn't a country, it's a continent with vast amounts of talent and a really individual way of working. But the great thing for us is that they speak English. So, you know, you can access this real, what appears to us, exotic culture, but you can still communicate. So that's kind of fabulous as well. But, you know, I get inspiration wherever I go. I mean, I spent a lot of time a few years ago in South America, and that is a revelation. They don't teach you about that at school here in Europe. You don't really know about the pre-Columbians.
It's great that you're finding not just new countries, but new continents and are able to be inspired by them. I rang in 2020 in India, and it was my first trip.
Whoa.
The last big, incredible travel memories of 2020 were India and Cartagena. So I'm with you on both of those. You released your second collaboration with IKEA this year. Can you tell me a bit about that partnership and what it was like to kind of return to that group in a completely different capacity?
It was great. You know, they're an impressive business. I mean, you know, the furniture business only has been disrupted by IKEA. You know, nobody else has managed to really do it, which is kind of interesting. And they've done it in a really unique way. So, I mean, it's good to return there knowing what I know. And, well, I mean, being a designer inside that, it facilitates a lot of things. And also, I think because I've been working a lot in slightly the higher end, you know, the luxury end, it's kind of refreshing also to be able to do things which are slightly more democratic and more affordable. And of course, with a giant organization like that, you do get much more kind of industrial support. So people are really interested in working with you in factory base, for instance, you know, so that was great.
And I'm sure it brings just a completely different way of looking at an object if you're doing it under such different parameters.
Yeah, and you know, they do benefit from a massive amount of high quality information about the way that people's lives are evolving, which you really wouldn't have access, you know, from anywhere else.
Right. So speaking of kind of looking at things in different ways, your hydro chair is 100% recyclable, and then you've also released collections made from cork and recycled marble residue. What are your thoughts on factoring sustainability into your use of materials?
Well, I mean, honestly, that's now the first question, not the last question for most people, you know, and it's becoming increasingly urgent to make everything or to start really making big changes in the way that we make things and how people consume things. I mean, I think we're just in baby steps here, but I mean, I guess the small advantage we've got in furniture business is more that intrinsically, the things are not made to be disposable. The biggest thing that we can concentrate our efforts on and be honest about is trying to build longevity into the products that we've got. I mean, I still personally live with things which are my great grandmother's, and she bought antiques, you know, so, and we're talking about seven generations of the use of an object there. So that's, that helps to think that you could possibly be slightly more sustainable than a few other trades that I can think of. That's one aspect. I think there are some success stories in lighting with LEDs reducing the use of energy, you know, in a measurable way. And then the experiments that we're undertaking in recycling and recycled materials are seem obvious, but have become much more complex in terms of sort of measuring the absolute impact of those actions, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I think we're taking it much more seriously, like everybody should. But there's only one real answer to it, which is that people should consume less. I mean, I do have the benefit of being old enough to have seen my stuff coming back on the secondhand market. And actually, you can find my stuff both in fake form and proper secondhand form on eBay.
Right.
And also in antique shops and also in auctions. So, you know, you get things which are cheaper on the secondary market and things that are more expensive on the secondary market. It's kind of interesting to see the second cycle coming around already.
Absolutely. What other challenges or opportunities are you most excited by tackling these days?
Well, you know, I mean, design's been a fantastic method of having every month, every week, sometimes every day, a new challenge. I'm still motivated by surprises more than anything. So it's just a great trade to be also delving into other people's worlds. So, you know, whether you're designing a restaurant or a cruise ship or exploring new materials or working with scientists or big corporations, you've always got a kind of different angle in it. So it's a way of exploring, a bit like journalism is or podcasting is, sticking your nose in other people's business, which is kind of nice. And
here we are.
And from, you know, things that interest me, I mean, you know, I've looked a lot with our restaurant here in London and various other projects into food, for sure. But most recently, it's been, you know, nature and definitely horticulture and that kind of stuff where I've been working, particularly during lockdown, in this greenhouse environment.
As a last question, a nice moment to ask it as you're sort of contemplating natural beauty and man-made beauty. What are your thoughts on the value of beauty?
That's a bit of a difficult one. You know, again, you know, if I think of my visits to museums, it's definitely in the eye of the beholder. I mean, and it's also much more subject to fashion than people would care to admit. Beauty and what people find beautiful changes actually really quite quickly. For me, beauty is things which are intemporal, you know, things that you can't really place in a fashion moment or a specific time, but still hold their originality. I find beauty a lot in the first of something, you know, in originality, real origins of an idea. But, you know, it's a personal thing, beauty. It's not an absolute.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. It was lovely to meet you.
Okay, my pleasure. And say hi to Vancouver. It's one of my favorite towns.
I will.
All right. Bye.
And that, beautiful people, concludes another episode of the Inspirati presented by Nuvo. Please rate and leave a comment if you're enjoying these conversations. You can follow the Inspirati and Nuvo Mag on Instagram or find me at alex.merrill. Stay inspired and keep creating.